So what's the name of this podcast?
Eugene
Cast.
How am I supposed to pronounce that?
Oig Cast.
A huge cast.
Huge cast.
You're listening to Huge Cast.
That's right. You're listening to Huge Cast, a volunteer-powered cooperative where we talk with people who may or may not live in the Eugene, Oregon area. We think they have some really cool stories to tell. So grab a pen and paper and take notes, because there's a quiz after.
What's your name?
My name is Howard Liebes.
Okay. How long have you lived in Eugene?
I've lived in Eugene for basically 31 years. If there was 3 years, I was in L.A., but I don't count those.
Okay. So what do you do in Eugene?
What do I do now in Eugene?
What do you...
Right now, I'm working on writing. I'm writing a series of science fiction novels.
Okay. How many books in the series?
There are 3 books in the series, I think. Right now.
So you're writing the novels, but you're not planning them.
No, I have them planned. I know exactly how it ends, but I'm not really sure what happens in between. I'm working on the second one right now. So I know what happens in the second one.
Okay, that's great.
I know the general arc of the series. I don't know exactly what happens in the entire series. That wouldn't be fun at all when you're writing something to know exactly what you're doing.
Exactly.
Where creativity guts come in somewhere, right?
Right. Tell me about the most Eugene thing you've ever done.
Most Eugene thing I've ever done. Wow. That's a large order. I have to think about that one. I may have to come back to that one.
Okay. Well, then here's an easy one, because this puts it in think. Tell me about your first experience in Eugene.
My first experience in Eugene, I'd never been here before. I'd driven through, but a year before, but I'd never been here. I was coming here to live and go to the university. And I rented a car at the airport in Portland, and I drove in from Portland, and I was going to camp out in Coburg while I looked for a place to live. But what happened was, I don't know, I'd never been here before.
Coburg, really?
Coburg, it was a KOA there. There was one back in 1987.
There still might be. It's right next to Condi's place, right?
I don't have no idea. I ended up going there. What happened was, I drove into town to kind of check out Eugene because I'd never been here before, and I drove around the university. And I saw this big sign outside the dorm that said Transient Hotel or something like that. I remember exactly what it said, but it was something, it was based, and I pulled over and went in there, and it was, I know what it was. I was walking around campus, and I went into the registrar's office, and I told them that I was, you know, from out of town. They're like, you know, there's a place for students to stay while they're looking for a place to live. I don't know if they still do that. It was the dorms right on the corner over by Hayward Field.
Right, the Hamilton complex. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I went over there, and it was like $5 a night. I don't remember how much it cost, or it cost anything. I had my, you know, I showed him my papers.
What kind of
my
papers?
My admissions papers.
Oh.
And I think I might have even gotten my ID at that point. I'm not really sure. But I went in, got my paper, told them I was a student, and I was looking for a place to live. And they're like, okay, well, here's a room you can take. And then I started looking for a room in Eugene, and I met all these people who were going to be college students in this. It was August 30th.
What year?
1987.
Okay.
And I met all these people who were going to be students, and through them, I found a place to live.
Are any of those people you still familiar with?
No, I don't think they live in town anymore. And one of them used to live in the same apartment building as I did, and I think she moved away. And the other one, I think he was a dancer. I don't know where he ended up. I don't think he's in Eugene anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a big...
I remember their names. Remember, his name was Michael, and her name was Laurie or something like that. Yeah. Anyway, it was a long time ago.
Well, 1987. Yeah, yeah. Hell yeah.
But yeah, it was my first experience in Eugene. It was very welcoming. It's, you know, I canceled my KOA reservation and I stayed there. It was awesome. I was like, wow, this is great. And then I just walked around town. I mean, I found a place within a week.
How'd you find a place?
The woman who I became friends with, she said she was from New Jersey and I was from New York. And she was like, hey, there's this place that reminds me of New York. It's like, right, it's really close to here. It's perfect. And they're looking, they have open apartments. And I went down there. It was the Florence Apartments. And
could you repeat that part, but use a Jersey accent? I'm sorry.
I can't do a Jersey. I can do a New York accent.
I hear that all the time from you. That's okay. Right. So your first experience in Eugene was basically looking for a place to live.
Exactly. That was my first experience in Eugene. It wasn't very exciting, sorry.
Okay. So can we come back around to the most Eugene thing you've ever done?
It was one of the first experiences I ever had in Eugene. I didn't know anybody here. I came here a month before the term started. Because I figured, you know, settle in, but it was a long month. I didn't know anybody, obviously. I just knew the people who I just mentioned. And about halfway through September, or it was pretty close to when school started, the woman from New Jersey said, hey, there's this thing called Eugene Celebration happening. You need to come check this out. We should go. And there's music and food and beer. And I was like, sure, let's go. And it was taking place over at that year. It was the lot next to Oregon Electric Station. And the stage was where Buffalo Exchange is, And it was packed with people. It was like jam-packed with people. I didn't know anybody except for this woman. And it was just like, I don't remember who was playing. It was totally a local band. It was like the Soulsations or someone like that, you know, from someone from that era.
Right.
I'm trying to remember. I remember the lead singer. He used to do Elvis.
And what year was this?
1987.
Okay.
And it was awesome. It was just so Eugene. It was like I was sitting there and, you know, maybe I should, you know, now that it's legal, I can say this. I was sitting there, standing there dancing, and this pipe went by and all these people were so welcoming and so awesome. Everyone was so, they're like, where are you from? Oh, wow. You know, I didn't know any of these people. And not that I became friends with them, but it was like this welcoming experience. And I thought, you know, I think I'm going to like this place.
So I take it, so your most Eugene experience early on was standing in a parking lot next to the railroad track smoking weed with people you didn't know.
Exactly. That was my most Eugene. So it kind of fit, except for the railroad tracks, it kind of fit every moment in Eugene, really.
Okay. We'll come back around. Okay. And if there's anything that comes along here in this conversation concerning
you?
Yeah. I will beep that shit out. Okay.
Should we say that we've known each other for a really long time?
I've been posting online that we don't know each other.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's a thing. I'm trying to get into the Supreme Court. And you might have some shit on me. Okay. Okay. So,
yes.
Favorite restaurant or eatery that you wish was still here, and why?
My favorite eatery was a place called Bob and, I think it was called Bob and Ev's. It was this small building across from, the building's still there. I think it's a taqueria now or something.
Where?
Across from a 99, across from the bowling alley.
Okay.
And it was this amazing, the food was amazing. I mean, the people had basically run this place for 40 years on 99. They were the nicest people. Mm-hmm. I had my 30th birthday there or something like that. Yeah.
So it was by the Embers Supper Club.
It was down the road from Embers, like not close to there at all, further down than that.
When did it leave?
I think it dissolved. It ended like in the early 90s. I don't know exactly the year.
What attracted you to this place?
It was very much, to me, it was kind of the epitome of this place. It was very welcoming, and it was home. It was of this place. It was very. Mm-hmm.
So far, everything that you've enjoyed in this town has been welcoming.
Exactly.
What were you running from?
I wasn't running. One of the things I didn't like when I lived in New York was everyone seemed like they, when I lived in downstate New York.
Yeah.
Everyone's, when I grew up, when I fled there from when I was 18, was like, no one would say hello to each other. No one was friendly. And it was wasn't a sense of community at all.
Right.
Maybe if you lived on the same block as somebody and they knew you for, since you were born, there the community existed. But, you know, I remember when I was in undergraduate school getting off the bus from Albany and walking through town and saying hello to people and getting like, this look of like, who the hell are you saying hello to me?
Right.
It's like, dude, yeah, whatever. I'm just walking down the street trying to be friendly, you know. But I always felt like there was a really great sense of community in this town. It's the reason why I stayed here and came back here every time I thought about going away for long periods of time.
Right. Okay, so currently.
Yes.
What is your favorite eatery?
I'd say one of the first favorite eatery that comes to mind is the place I can't pronounce correctly.
Jesus. Do you want me to say it and then you can say it back?
Taco Vor.
Right. Or as we like to say, the Tacover.
Like Tacovery.
The Tacovery. Oh, that's the breakfast place.
Yeah. And, my other favorite place would be the Black Wolf Tavern. Black Wolf. Supper Club.
Okay, Black Wolf Supper Club.
Yeah. I love the food there. It's amazing. It's just like every bite is just astounding.
And where is that?
It is over by the railroad station, one building away from the railroad station.
Mm-hmm.
Next to...
Morning Glory.
Thank mm-hmm. you.
You're welcome.
And across the street from Jackalope.
Right. Which I haven't been in a long time. Have you been in the Jackalope lately?
Not a long time. Mm-hmm.
That sounds like there might have been an incident.
No. I could say something I didn't want to say over the air. But yeah, I just am not my favorite place anymore.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll dig into that later. What are you currently involved in that excites you and why?
I would say my work. I'm really excited about... The thing I'm really excited about right now is the work I'm doing on this book. I'm pretty much all in, so to speak.
Hmm. You know? I mean, you've been an author for a long time now. You've written a lot of stuff.
Right, but the project that I haven't been really immersed like this in a project that's my own, that's not someone else's project, in a really long time. I think it's probably been, I can't remember the last, I mean, when I was living in LA, I was working on a project, but I never finished it. On my own, but this one, it's like I'm working on something and knowing that I have a plan to finish and get it done and be immersed in it, and it's a completely different thing. I don't think I've done anything like that since. I mean, when I was writing those pieces for the LA Times magazine, I was pretty immersed in those. So it's probably been 2000. It's been almost 20 years.
So
been
why
that long, Jesus Christ?
So why is it that all of a sudden now it's the time, and this is the place?
I would say the reason it's the time and the place would be I hate to use the term midlife crisis. A midlife, like basically saying to myself, you know what? If I'm going to do it, I need to do this now.
Mm-hmm.
I need to do what really makes me happy and not work on other people's stuff. I mean, of course, you know, you need to make money and you need to work on other people's stuff sometimes. But, I mean, like, to totally be not involved in the music business anymore. and to do what really makes me happy, which is writing.
So tell me a little bit about what you've done during your time in Eugene that has made you kind of have your identity here and have you've made a mark on this town.
Ooh, my identity here. I would say my identity here was start in Eugene as a town and make my mark here. Mm-hmm. When I was at the University of Oregon, I started doing readings and I met a bunch of people who are writers. Mm-hmm. And I put together Emergency Horse with those people.
And what was that?
Emergency Horse was a magazine. We used to call it a cross between Mad Magazine and Atlantic Monthly. And it was a thing, we had very humorous things, but we also had very serious, and we had, arts articles. Like we interviewed Callahan, the comic mm-hmm. book artist. We mm-hmm. interviewed Bukowski. Mm-hmm. Ginsburg and people like that. And we also had hard-hitting news, like with the revolutions were happening. The wall was falling in Latvia and Lithuania. Mm-hmm. And we also had things like, comics, mm-hmm. well-known comics from the Northwest doing stuff. We had record reviews. We had just general...
What year was that?
That was 1990 through 1992.
Wow, that was early.
Yeah.
And then what?
It lasted for a year and a half, but it took us about two years altogether. We did that, and it was great. We had distribution in Eugene and Portland, Seattle, and we had the one guy in the group would drive around and spread them out into independent bookstores around the Northwest, which we couldn't do now because there aren't that many independent bookstores left. Mm-hmm. But, and even in California, and we had people who subscribed to it, mostly family and friends who were supporting us. But it was a great thing, We broke even. We never lost money. It was an awesome thing we did. And there are people here who I'll tell them what I did, and they'll mention a magazine, and they'll be like, oh, I love that magazine, and that makes me feel good about it. Mm.
Okay, so then what did you do after that?
And after that, I came back from Europe, and I was I came back from Europe in winter of 93. I was in Minneapolis, and I ended up coming back here in 94, and I was totally broke, and I ended up being the business manager for the Cherry Pop and Daddies. Hmm. And then I ended up becoming their manager eventually, and that was a big part of my life from 1994 to 1999. I did that, and
they were a pretty big regional group.
They were a pretty big regional group, and even when I took over in 94, they were making pretty good money in the Northwest. Mm-hmm. And the plan that I worked out with Steve, who's the lead singer and pretty much the organizer at that point, because a lot of people, the original people had left, was making it a national band. Mm-hmm. And we put out our own records. And we created an independent record label. And and we toured for 3.5 years. And then things started happening. Mm-hmm. Like we got signed and... sold 2 million albums, and it was just crazy. But mm-hmm. it was great. And that's, for people who remember that time, I can mention that to people now who are younger and they're like, who? But they were big in their time here, and they were, as far as nationally and internationally, I hate to say use the term one hit wonder, but hey, it was fine. We did okay. It was a great experience.
Right.
In a lot of ways, it was a horrible experience. In a lot of ways, but it's good. Okay, it is what it was. Such is life.
Right. So then, after the Daddies, you moved.
After the Daddies, moved down to LA for 3 years. Even though I kind of kept my residency here, you might want to edit that out. I might get in trouble for that one.
Did you vote?
I did vote.
Here?
Yes, my residency was in Oregon.
Okay, well, I was trying to get that on tape.
But
so then after LA, you moved back up here.
Yeah.
You've been doing various things in the music industry. Yeah.
Yeah. I was in from 2003 till about 2015, till the end of 2014, actually. I was in the music business. Managed, had a record label called Happy Mistake Records.
Mm-hmm.
I put out the band called The Ovulators.
Oh, The Ovulators. I remember that.
Falcon. And moving back to Eugene was awesome. I don't regret moving back here from LA at all. and I did the record label. It didn't last very long, but then I managed, I managed The Visible Men.
Mm-hmm.
It's Mr. Dan Schmid and Mr. Mm-hmm. Dustin Lanker. Mm-hmm. And Jordan Glenn. And then I managed a bunch of Poetry Portland bands, like I Can Lick Any Son of a Bitch in the House, and Hill Stomp, and the Quick and Easy Boys, and I booked up Skate Omega, and Sarsaparilla. I kind of got into the Junkyard Blues, kind of.
Did you do Mad Caddies, too?
I did them. Mad Caddies, they're from Santa Barbara. I did that from 2013 to 2015.
Mm-hmm. And then you started working on your books.
Yep.
Novels. Right. Sorry.
Books, novels, yeah. It's fiction.
Okay. So on the topic of music, events, and shows.
Sir.
Okay. What is one of the most interesting events or shows that you've attended recently?
I think one of the most interesting ones I attended recently was when Yob was playing at the Wow Hall
mm-hmm.
for their latest record. I hadn't seen him play in a really long time, and the place was packed, and once again, it was a lot of familiar faces.
And that was just this year?
Yep. It was just this past year, yep.
2017, 2018?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. I'm trying to think when it was. I think it was February.
Mm-hmm. Why was it interesting?
It was just great. It reminded me of the old days. It was packed with people and a lot of friends, and it was like, you know, they're from here, and they're an amazing band, and it was just
Tell me about the venue.
The Wow Hall?
Mm-hmm.
The Wow Hall. What about the Wow Hall? What would you like to know about the Wow Hall?
Tell me about the Wow Hall. What do you know about the Wow Hall?
Oh, God. What do I know about the Wow Hall? Well, the daddies used to play the Wow Hall all the time. We used to pack out that place to the point where it was probably beyond the fire marshal codes. I think it says on the door that's like 300 is the most people in that place. We used to put 600 people in that place. It was ridiculous. But the Wow Hall I think it's one of the most important places in town because it's all community run. It's nonprofit. It's been here forever. It's was started by a bunch of people. I believe it was started by a bunch of people who were from the Oregon Country Fair. I'm not really sure about that. Don't quote me on that. But it was just the Wow Hall. A lot of good times.
It was one of the few all ages places.
Yes, thank you for that. Yes, all ages places in town, which it is the only old. Does Hi-Fi do all ages? I'm not really sure. I don't know.
I don't know. But the Wow Hall for many years was the only
all-ages place in town.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the daddies would play and there'd be like people would bring their kids and for better or for worse, people would bring their kids and it's awesome. And I was just there this weekend and it was, you know, the average age in that place had to be, you know, 15 to 25. It was it's great.
So that wasn't creepy for you at all.
I stood at the back of the room. Let's put it that way.
No mosh pit for Levis.
You know, I always thought that, you know, when I was growing up, there wasn't anything like that. I mean, we went to go see, like, you know, ELO at the Madison Square Garden. That was like the all ages events. There wasn't really, or we went to, you know, when I was old enough, we'd go to a bar and see punk rock bands. But when I was younger, you couldn't. That type of thing did not exist at all where I grew up. So I think it's great because I was really into music and I would love to have gone to those shows when I was that age.
When was the first time you remember going to the Wow Hall?
God, before I started working for the Daddies, I don't think I was involved in music. I really didn't go to shows much in this town. I went to like Taylor's for the blues thing because it was right by the university where I lived.
Right.
Knew a couple people who played at that event. But I didn't really go out that much to shows. I remember going, and so I think the Wow Hall, I really didn't go to the Wow Hall until I was really involved in music. Mm-hmm. And I used to go all the time, not just for Daddy shows. I mean, there used to be the thriving indie scene, all the independent labels in Portland come down here and play. And I had a bunch of friends, obviously, who played in bands. So I'd go to Wow Hall and see them. And back in those days, I mean, there were a lot of shows with local bands and it would be packed out. I don't know how it is now. Hmm.
So if I was to tell you that the Wow Hall was going to close their doors next week.
Oh, I'd be bummed.
Right.
Is that true?
No.
Oh, good.
Well, actually, I don't know. They may. I don't know. I mean, it's like, you know.
No, it's an important cornerstone in the community, most right. definitely.
So that's a big, you know. Now that I think about it, the Wow Hall always was that place where we could get crazy.
Oh yeah.
You know, back in the older days, so many shows.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I'm getting older. I don't go that much anymore, and they don't really. It's kind of cut back on. I believe they've cut back on the amount of shows they do and local shows they do, just because it's so expensive to open it up.
Right. Why?
You got to pay the sound people. You got to pay the monitor people. You got to pay. I mean, it's just like just. I think it's just. I think it's. I don't. You know. It's just expensive to rent.
Okay.
I think once you set up a certain parameters of what something costs, then you have to live with that. And I think that has to be either people have to either move that for local people or not. And I think that in a lot of ways, the Wow Hall could benefit from being a little more flexible in that regard, because. But I also understand they have some certain financial things and goals they have to meet. So
right. So talk a little bit about what you think about, because you've done a lot of work in the music business, booking shows.
Oh, Jesus, yes.
Okay. So I don't want to go down a rabbit hole.
Let's
with
not
you.
Go down that rabbit hole, please. Okay.
Well, I want you to touch on the rabbit hole a little bit. I would like you to talk about
how
the scene in Eugene
has changed
for music and entertainment and venues, and how the national market and music business has impacted the way we consume things.
You want me to repeat that question all back to you?
No.
Wow. Well, let's see. Back in the 90s, it was a lot different. I mean, as far as how much it cost to go to shows, it wasn't like you were pulling out $40, which, I mean, it seemed less financially impactful on your life to go out to a show. Mm-hmm. Let's see, there was the Wow Hall. Back in the 90s, there was Wow Hall, there was John Henry's, there was Good Times. There was Harpo's or the Butte Tavern and Taylor's. There wasn't really, and then there was every once in a while, like another all ages. Like I knew earlier in the 80s, I know there were a lot of all ages. There's a bunch of all ages stuff going on, mm-hmm. especially during the 80s, during the early days of the SST years and things like that. Well, I wasn't here during that period of time. There used to be a lot of like independent stuff going on all ages wise, but that kind of dried up. Around that time.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. There weren't many places. There were a lot of places that were basement parties. Mm-hmm. Those kind of dried up, but they existed a little bit back in the day when I was here. I could go see bands in basements of houses, like punk rock shows in basements of houses.
What Monkey House? You remember
Monkey House? I love that place. Yeah. Oh, it was a kind of a okay. hole, but it was a nice place.
Yeah,
another.
You remember where that was?
Yep.
Where was that?
It was on the corner of Pearl and 19th.
Yeah, so it was like, this is like 19.
And now there's a duplex complex sitting on the corner.
Yeah, they ripped it down. So it was that was 1989 through maybe 92?
Maybe, yeah. No, because Billy Jack played there, so it had to be later than that. So it was like 95 maybe. And they did, but they used to do a lot more like in the late in the 80s and then in the early 90s, and then it kind of like died off. And there used to be, I think, noise ordinances and things like that, and people not wanting to deal with, you know, the security issues of having punk rock shows and people dealing with that. I think those things stop people from doing those kinds of shows. Alcohol issues in places where there shouldn't be alcohol, and the cops showing up and blah blah blah, you know, that sort of like that area where people don't want to go. Mm-hmm. I think that's why those venues don't exist anymore. I used to be a little bit more you could get away with it. Mm-hmm. But I think that type of thing, like, you know, like back in the day we could put posters on telephone poles. You can't do that anymore. It's like $150 fine or more now. I don't know how much it is.
I just saw somebody putting one up the other day.
If someone saw them do it and they used to be, back in the day we used to cover those telephone poles with posters. Remember those
Right.
Yeah, you don't see that much anymore.
Yeah, all the old daddy's posters used to be.
Oh, my God. We used to spend so much time making those posters and walking down 13th going, cock, 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 with a staple gun, just putting up those posters. Yeah, that was part of the deal. If you played in Eugene, you got to put those posters up.
Yeah.
So getting back to your question. So, yeah, I mean, there used to be those venues. There was just the Wow Hall. There was John Henry's. It was... There seemed to be, maybe, you know, this might be a product of me getting older and not going to shows as much, but there used to be a lot more bands. There used to be more bands coming through town, I thought, back in the day. Mostly because I think, especially John Henry's, the people who were running John Henry's were like these intense music people who were like wanted these bands coming through, and they'd, you know... And the other thing you have to take into account is what the music, how the music business was back then. You had gas was only $1.50, mm-hmm. maybe at the most, back in the '80s and nineties, $1.20, $1.50. So you could have a van and you could drive around, and it was not that expensive to tour, mm-hmm. right? So if you didn't make a ton of money, it didn't really matter that much. Motels were really cheap. Mm-hmm. There were KOAs too. You know, when mm-hmm. everyone did that, you'd sleep on people's floors all the time.
You still have people sleeping on your floors coming
yep.
through town.
Yeah, it's true. I do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mostly farts like me, but yeah. But
I wouldn't call you a fart.
But yeah, I mean. And so the bottom line was a lot different. You could charge $5 a show to see like the Super Suckers, mm-hmm. or Turbo Negro, who are huge now. But back, I mean, even back then, I mean, they're coming from overseas, and still it was cheap to go see these bands. You know, I mean, on Daddy's Post, you'd probably check out the prices. It was like $5.
And that was $8. The most expensive.
Yeah, and that was expensive, and it wasn't a lot of money. I mean, you know, it was a sandwich, maybe. What, $5 back then? So it wasn't like, yeah,
you
it
could get a burrito at
yeah, exactly.
At, what was that? Well, anyway, yeah, you know,
at Sandino's.
Sandino's
next to John Henry's.
I was thinking Sandino's when it was over on 13th.
Oh yeah, I remember that too. Yeah, it was a much different thing. The bottom line was completely different. And people would gladly go to those shows because, like, you know, you're listening to that music, you $5, hell yeah. It's not like every show at John Henry's or Wow Hall or it was sold out, but usually, I mean, the place stayed open for a while. People would go to shows. I think what happened... And also, you know, bands could sell CDs, which were, if you had one song on the album that people wanted, you got to buy the CD, right? So, and you made CDs for $1 and you sold them for 10. So it totally paid, like one CD paid for how many gallons? You sold five CDs.
Yeah, you could get to Portland.
Yeah. Yeah. So you had these, the financial aspects of it were different. So the reason people don't stop in Eugene anymore is because A, the ticket prices have to be a lot higher. B, people don't, and so in order to pay for the bottom line of this touring band that's coming through. And so you have this aspect of bands not stopping here because they know people in Portland, there's more people there. People are going to show up. You know, the percentage of people are going to show up there compared to the percentage of people going to show up in Eugene is different. The other thing is, you know, people aren't making money on their CDs anymore, so they can't pay for gas that way. So the only way they're going to pay for their gas is other shows.
Right.
So why are they going to stop here and make no money and then not be able to pay for, you know, makes no sense. You know, now you have, you know, the digital world, which is awesome in so many ways, the streaming world. You can get any music you want, any time you want on your phone or, you know, or your laptop or whatever, but you can't, but musicians aren't, you know, on Spotify, if you're a band who's not well known, you're literally making 0.002 cents per song. That's you when you play a song. And bands are not going to make a living off that. Mm-hmm. The whole record album thing is happening, but record albums, unless you have a record label doing it, are pretty expensive to make.
Right. And not everybody's going to drop a 20 spot on a piece of vinyl.
On a band they just saw.
Right. Yeah. Especially when they have to take a cab home drunk.
Right. Right. Or they paid $40 to get in to see the show.
Right. Okay. So on that topic of...
So that's why, that's the difference between what's going on now, what's going on then. And now there aren't less venues. There are venues still. Like
they're smaller.
They're smaller. They don't do as many shows as they did. Like Sam Bonds does as many shows as they used to do. Hi-Fi doesn't do a show every day.
You have the McDonald's. Which is new.
McDonald, which is awesome. But you can't, but they're doing less shows because it's so expensive to do and bands aren't coming through as much as that. I mean, look at the McDonald. When they first started out, they used to do shows way more frequently than they do now. Now you're, and the Cuthbert's great, but that's in the summertime, spring, summer, right? Mm-hmm. I think the Cuthbert might be the best thing in town, you know? We get some amazing acts coming through and it's really, for the acts that are coming through, it's not that expensive, really.
Right.
You know. You see. You know. We saw Snoop Dogg and the Redmen and Cypress Hill would pay like $40 for that show. $60 for that. That was freaking amazing to see all those bands for that much money, and it was, but for the there are venues, and I mean, Hi-Fi is a great addition to the community. World Pies now is where Cosmic used to be. John Henry's doesn't exist anymore. Sam Bond still does some really good stuff. And then there's Old Nick's, which is a little more on the metal side and the harder side and the punk rock side. But
Okay.
I don't know if I answered that question.
Yeah, you did. Yeah. Okay, so what's the most common misconception about Eugene?
The most common misconception about Eugene would be it's a small town full of hippies, which might have been the case back in the 80s, but it's definitely been Californized in the last 30 years, and it's definitely changed.
Is it positive or negative there?
I thought it was a positive. I loved the whole hippie side of this town, and I think... the things that still exist from that era, like Whitebird and the Wow Hall and Oregon Country Fair, and I think that people still come here because of that, even though it's not the main instant. It's not like, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not the main focus of the community anymore. But I think that spirit still exists in this town, and I think that's why it makes it so great.
So do you think, bringing this back to the original thing that you were talking about early on when you first came here, and the stuff that was really kind of drew you here the first time, and then again,
right,
and then again you came back. Like, you couldn't get away from it. What was it about that? What was it about this town? Where does that come from? And is that still here? Is that part of the hippie 1980s?
I think that people are I think it's part of the hippies 1980s. I think this is my example of why I only really moved away and came back once. Mm-hmm. But
that's what you think.
I'm living by that answer.
whatever they told you in witness protection.
This is my example. Okay, when I lived in LA, you'd go to a party and you'd meet somebody. Mm-hmm. And yeah, not that way, Adam. Get your mind out of the gutter. You'd meet somebody and you'd talk to them. And the minute you'd be like, "What do you do for a living?" Mm-hmm. And it'd be like, "I'm a writer. What are you writing on?" "Well, I'm writing this book about Beverly Hills, blah blah blah." "Oh, really? Okay. Nice to meet you. Bye." Mm-hmm. When I would come back to Eugene in that period of time, I met a bunch of new people who I'm really good for, mm-hmm. who I'm really good friends with right now, mm-hmm. and I will be until I'm older and grayer. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much grayer I could get, but you know, it was more like I'd come back to town and I'd start talking to these people, and I realized I'm going to be friends with these people. You know, it was a little more of a personal level. It's like, "How are you?" "Oh, really? You came here from New York? Really? Oh, wow. What do you do?" "Oh, that's cool." You know, we talk about mm-hmm. music. We talk about what we read. We talk about our lives. We become friends, you know, and that's kind of what I was saying about the whole Eugene celebration thing. It's like coming back to that. It's like it was immediately the sense of, wow, these people are like human beings who want to connect on a human level, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's the reason why I keep coming back here, is because I think that that is really important as a person. I saw this TED talk mm-hmm. where this guy was a Harvard researcher, and he was talking about this study he'd done over 40 years or something like that. And they'd found that people who had relationships and friendships and on a certain level would live longer than other people.
Hmm. So,
and that's not the reason I'm living in Eugene, but that's it pretty much affirmed how I always felt about this town.
Mm-hmm. So let's think about now then. Do you think if someone like you, a 21-year-old guy who just graduated from college and who's going to go to grad school,
okay,
would have the same experience in this town, or would be able to engage in this town in the same way you did back in the day, in the 80s, could they do that in 2018?
I don't think they could do it the same way, because a lot has changed as far as the way the community interacts with the college, university interacts with the community. I think there's a little difference in that way. But if they were a person who went out to events and went to shows and they went to readings and they went to places where people had common interests, mm-hmm. that they could find that. But I think that it's changed a lot in the way, like when I was at the university, there was a lot of interaction between people in the community and people who were like the artists and the writers mm-hmm. and the musicians. I'd go out someplace and I'd meet them and it'd be like, "Hey, you want to come to our show, or do you want to do a reading, or do you want to?" There seemed to be more of a cross. Like, I've never been at a bar and met and become like someone from the university talking to me, and that they come to the show. Like, it's like it just seems like there's the crossover between the university and the. Community is a little bit different than it used to be. I think it does exist if someone actually put themselves out there, mm-hmm. but the way it used to be, everything used to be closer to the university. You had the Great Society Cafe, you had Taylor's, you had Sahaley's, you had these places where people could hang out, mm-hmm. Where people from the community hung out too. And the community used to be, the other thing was, the community used to be closer to university. All the musicians and writers and artists, we all lived on Patterson. And, you know, on fucking Harris, you know, we used to live like right next to the university. But now, I don't know if people could afford, who are writers and artists, could afford to live next to the university too. I think that's changed. So that would be my answer to that question.
What would you hope for about the future of Eugene?
My hope would be keeping the same theme that I've kind of been tacking back and forth on. I'd hope it would keep the elements that it's kept, even though I know that it's growing. Well, it's grown. Well, it's 100,000 when I first moved here. Now it's, what, 160,000 or something like that? Springfield, I don't really know what the population is there. But I think that the area is, you know, more people are coming here to find that thing I've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think that... I'm hoping those people will influence the future of the town, you know, instead of people who are coming here to just make a buck, you know, they're coming here. Well, everyone comes here. I mean, everyone's going to make a buck, but you know what I mean? There's like, there aren't some people who come here because they want to make it a better place or make it as good a place as it's always been. And there are people who come here because they, well, it's cheap and I just want to fucking work here. Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so hang on. So,
I think I'm answering. I don't know if I'm answering that question. But.
So, your hope for the future of Eugene?
My hope for the future of Eugene is that it keeps the qualities of community that it's always kept. And
what does that look like?
What does that look like? Mm-hmm. I'd say inclusive, diverse. Everyone accepting one another. Everyone caring about even someone on the street, caring about people who are in need.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what would make you leave Eugene?
What would make me leave Eugene? Well, let me tell you what would make me leave Eugene, Adam. what would make me leave Eugene would be, the bottom line would be it getting ridiculously expensive. Like San Francisco type of expensive, where it was just like, go to get a sandwich and it's like $25 or something like that. You know, or go, you know, just, I think the fact is, I think that people are already suffering from the whole wage versus rent gap. Mm-hmm. And I think that cities are becoming, Eugene is like one of the last bastion, was one of the last bastions where people could move here and be like, I want to create, I want to do stuff. Oh, the rent's not expensive. I can create my own existence here and try to make what I, that's one of the things I loved about Eugene. Like people would go, I want to do this thing. Well, it's really, you know, I'm only have to pay $100-$200 rent so I can afford to build this business and, or build this thing. And, oh, now it's a media company, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, or it's a restaurant, or it was a, you know, I think that those elements of creating your own existence, I'm concerned that might go away. That might not drive me away, but I think if it got really to it, if it became like a city that was congested, mm-hmm. That's one of the things I hated about living in downstate New York was, or living in LA. You know, I had friends who were 20 miles away and it would take me an hour to get to them. It was just ridiculous. And I can see that kind of happening already. I can see that the roads are kind of meeting. If you drive during rush hour, it takes like, it used to take nothing to get across town. Now you're like, it could take a half hour to get across town or more. And Eugene, you know, I'd say the thing that would make me not want to live here is if it got too congested or too expensive and people couldn't live here. And it became like some place where it reminded me of the place I left, you know, and then the whole sense of community got washed out. Mm. And people were just like so intent on their daily routines that they didn't give a good damn about anybody else, you know.
Wouldn't that be... How do you think that happens? How could that happen here?
Well, I think, you know, you have an influx of people from other places who see it as a relatively cheap place. Mm. You know, people from San Francisco who are paying ridiculous amounts of money, and they go, oh, well, in Eugene, it's like half of it has half, it's half as expensive.
Right.
I can move here. And the reason they're moving here isn't because of what Eugene gives them as far as community and all the other things that I love about this town, but it gives them financial security, which is great. But on the other hand, it would change why people would come here, why people are coming here, right? So that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So kind of like people from downstate New York coming here in the 1980s, you came here for school.
Yeah, I came here for school, but I also knew what Eugene was.
Right.
I wasn't like totally blind to what I was coming into.
Right.
You know? I didn't know anybody here, but I also knew it was a small city. It was like, well, okay, so I lived in Albany, New York for 6 years before. I went to school there, and I stayed 2 years after that. So I kind of knew what a smaller city was like. Eugene was smaller than Albany, New York, but on the other hand, it was exactly the type of place I wanted to live in. So it wasn't like I knew when I was moving here, it was the type of community it was a certain specific type of community. I wasn't coming here because it was less expensive.
Right. What was the rent like when you first moved here? How much was the rent?
I paid $190 for a one-bedroom apartment with a Murphy's bed in the living room and a bedroom.
In what year?
1987. Mm-hmm. For at the floor in the Florence Apartments for $190.
Mm-hmm. Who was the owner of the Florence Apartments in the 1980s?
I don't remember, God, what were their last names? Juanita and her husband, Doc Rankin.
Mm-hmm.
They were interesting characters. Mm-hmm. They were definitely characters. They were always very nice to me, though. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Juanita and I got along really well. She loved the fact that I was a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And she always very nice to me.
Doc and Juanita Rankin.
Yeah.
An institution.
They were an institution.
Yeah.
They owned a lot of properties.
Yeah. Can we go into some Doc and Juanita Rankin here for a minute?
Sure.
Because you probably knew them better than, well, you knew Juanita.
Yep.
More than anybody knew Juanita.
Well, I don't know about that.
I mean, I don't want to get into any of your, you know, past relationships, but she died before Doc. But like, so you were living in the Florence apartment.
I lived in the Florence apartment. She was on the, I was on the, I don't know how many floors were in that place. Five, six
yeah.
floors.
So just for the listeners here, the Florence Apartments is on the corner of 13th and Willamette.
One building over,
right across from what is now Kinko's FedEx.
Right.
Actually, it's right across the street from where we are sitting right now in the Elbow Room at Trifoya.
Right.
It's...
And the thing, when I first moved there, Kinko's wasn't there. That was an empty parking lot, empty lot.
Really?
And going back to the whole music business, all ages thing, in the where Level Up is,
mm-hmm.
in that big room in the... at the end of Level Up, like the furthest, it was a warehouse, and there was a skateboard ramp in there, and there was punk rock bands used to play there.
Oh, I think I remember that.
That was in 1987, 88. Yeah. There weren't many punk rock things going on, but they do shows there once in a while, but the ramp was in that.
Right.
There. So that was like, yeah, that was 1987. Juanita, so I forget, was it the fourth floor? Fourth floor corner apartment. It was great because you could look out over into the mountains, looked over the church. The mm-hmm. mountains were there. It was a great little corner apartment. She lived on the second floor and on the other corner.
Mm-hmm.
And I always go downstairs and give her my rent check. She'd ask how I was doing. And I guess I don't remember exactly the details of it, but she was a concert violinist
right.
in her time.
Right.
And so she loved music too, you know. We didn't talk that much about music, but you'd go down there and there'd be classical music playing, and she'd like, hold on a minute, and she'd like take her needle off whatever mm-hmm. she was listening to. But as you know what happens, she was running the Hominy businesses out of that place.
Right. Well, if I remember correctly, Doc and Juanita Rankin.
And Doc lived across the hall.
Right. And they owned, I think, anywhere between 50 to 100 houses.
I don't know about 100, that many.
Okay.
Maybe 25 to 50.
It's me you're talking to.
Yeah, 25 okay. to 50, yeah.
Okay, 25 to 50, anywhere between 2 and 3 or 4 bedroom houses all over Eugene.
All over Eugene.
Okay, and you could tell that they were Rankin houses because they were all painted white. They came furnished with what these days could be considered
antique roadshow type.
Antique roadshow or like Northwest hip.
And the from what I saw, I saw a picture of the one of the Florence apartments that were for rent, and one of the refrigerators was one of the, it was a GM refrigerator, which right. is probably from 1962 or something. Right.
And that was like a newer one.
Exactly.
And then the basement in the Florence apartment
was filled with furniture.
Filled with furniture. And so and then Doc Rankin, he would drive around town in I think it was a 1936 Cadillac.
Was a Hudson?
No, it was a Caddy.
Was it a Caddy?
It was a Caddy.
But it was like low to the ground, like the shocks were completely
Shot. Yeah. If anything, he just took the shocks off and put like 2 pieces of metal.
Literally it was like maybe a foot off the ground.
Right. So this guy's driving around town in a rusty old Cadillac full of plumbing parts and tools in the back seat.
But it was a Cadillac. I think it was a Hudson.
I always thought it was a Cadillac.
But it was an older Cadillac. It was rounded. It wasn't
It was old, like 36.
Yeah.
Because Juanita had the newer one.
New, with the
and, fin, that was, and that was 1950s.
With the fins on the back.
Yes.
And they had an over right behind here, right? Mm-hmm. A block over. I don't know if they're still there, but they probably owned them, and they were garages.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. On between 13th and 12th, 13th and 14th. I mean, sorry. Yeah, between 13th and 14th on Pearl, there was in the back, it was an alley, mm-hmm. and it was a garages back there. I don't know, they might still be there, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But she had like, there a I remember going, walking by or biking by one time when the door was open, there was a bunch of cat, like, brand new Cadillacs, like not brand new, but you know, 1950s, just an amazing condition.
Right.
Her Cadillac was in amazing condition.
Right. But so if you ran into Doc Rankin on the street and you didn't know him, what would be your first thought?
This is a man who needs a handout.
Basically, yeah.
He was a real, yeah. yeah. I mean, and the thing is, like, I never saw Juanita out that much.
Right.
I mean, she was definitely went out and did stuff. I mean, I would be sitting on the porch and she would come in, but she never like, but she didn't, she wasn't like that at all. She was like a fine woman. She like dressed well, and she, you wouldn't think that of her.
Yeah.
You wouldn't just think she was loaded. I mean, it wasn't,
was she?
I would imagine that they were doing pretty well, that those houses had been paid off. Like,
right.
It's not like they were putting a lot of money into those houses.
Really? Coming from me, I lived in about 4 Rankin houses over the course of the many
right.
years that I lived here. Rent was always $250 a month per person. So it was $500 for a 2-bedroom, furnished.
Yep.
And, you know, dust included. And and Doc Rankin, I don't think he wore a different outfit for weeks. The guy was unkept.
But the thing was, he was literally a doctor.
He was a doctor, yeah. I remember he used to smoke his pipe all the time.
Did he have when we were there? I don't even know. Maybe you can answer this for me because I don't remember. Was he practicing still?
I think somebody told me that he still was, and I couldn't believe it.
Me too.
Yeah.
Someone told me he was still practicing, but someone told me actually that when he was a kid that his family went to his practice.
Right.
What did he do? Wasn't it Cairo?
No. He was a
general practitioner.
I think so. Yeah, yeah. So he smoked that pipe all the time, and he would constantly stick his thumb in the pipe.
Totally.
To the point where all of the skin on his thumb
exactly.
was basically corroded off, and it was like just bone.
But it was tobacco stained.
Yeah, but it looked like his bone was sticking out. I always felt like, yeah. You know, it was just a thing. Anyway.
They were their characters, both of them. But, yeah, but, you know, I didn't deal with him at all.
You moved out of the Florence apartments.
I lived there for...
Before Juanita died.
Yeah. Right. I lived there from 87 to about to 90.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the Florence apartments, I mean, that's... We could do an entire conversation.
I know
about
so many people who have lived there too. It's And that was the awesome thing about that place was when I was talking about going back to the beginning of our conversation, when the woman from New Jersey was like, "You'll love this place." And we walk, I don't know if you know, you walk in that place, you walk up the stairs, and there's that elevator with the gate.
Mm-hmm,
and when I was a kid growing up in Brooklyn, my grandmother and my aunt and uncle lived in this building in Brooklyn, and a bunch of my other aunts and uncles. My cousins live in this building. And you'd like, you know, you'd go in, you'd slide the gate, and you'd close the door, and you'd slide the gate, and you'd press the button. It was like, it was the same exact thing. It was just creepy. But to me, it was like, not creepy, but it was just like, felt like home in this weird way.
Right.
You know? this is a great, great Florence apartment story. When I lived there, you probably heard the story before. When I lived there, I had a really bad day at school, and I was just like in my brain, I was thinking about stuff, and I pressed the wrong button, the elevator, and I walked up to the door and I opened the door, and I was on the third floor, and I opened the door and I was in someone else's apartment, and I slammed the door, like got all flushed and went upstairs. And I kind of knew this woman who lived there from the graduate school. And she was like, "Howard, were you just in my apartment?" I was like, "Yeah, I don't know why my key worked. It freaked me out." She's like, "We need to fix this." I'm like, "Yeah, probably."
Good luck. All the keys open all the apartments, dude. But they're just for looks.
Well, that was the whole, I don't know whether this happened or not, but Wayne used to tell me this story.
Wayne who?
Shella Barger. Okay. Told me the story about how Juanita would, when people weren't there, she'd go into their apartments to check out the apartments to make sure everything was okay in there. And there were times when I'd go into my apartment after a day of school and I'd be like, and it would smell differently. And I'd be like, there was somebody else in here. And then Wayne told me this years later and I was like, holy crap. She actually like was doing that. She was going into the apartments and like, because in the rental agreement, there was a line that was like, you know, the landlord can check it out anytime, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting place.
Tell me about Wayne Shellebarger.
I met Wayne Shellebarger when he was 19 years old and an undergraduate at the U of O, and I was doing Timberline magazine, which doesn't exist anymore. But it was when I came to the U of O, there wasn't a literary magazine, and this guy named Clay Hutto got the ASUO, the Associated Students of the University of Oregon, to give him money to start a literary magazine, and I was the editor the second year. And I met Wayne, and he met Wayne through somebody in the graduate school, and he was 19 years old, and she was like, "This guy is incredible. You got to check out his artwork." And I was like, "Hey, man, you should want something of your art in the literary magazine because I wanted to do art too. One of the things I had stories and art. I just wanted to be literary. I wanted to be a literary and arts magazine." And then Wayne and I, you know, we became friends. And when I started doing the things with the Daddies, he was doing the posters for the Daddies, which were
a reverend,
they were something else. Wayne is a very unique individual, and his view on things and it was kind of pop culture meets horror meets a very dark sense of humor.
Could you describe one of these posters for our listening audience?
Oh, man. Well, my favorite one is the Jerry Garcia one.
Okay.
The Dead were playing at Autzen. This is 94. And the Daddies were managed by Bill Graham Presents this time, not by me. I was just the business manager and was kind of running things. And it was a clown.
The poster was a
clown standing up, and Jerry Garcia bent over, and the clown kicking Jerry Garcia in the ass, And the thought bubble, the thing was, the clown was saying, Jerry Garcia was saying, I'm an incredible farce. I'm an incredible fake or something like that. It was something derogatory. Mm-hmm. And then Dana, the trumpet player for that, is hung it up in the backstage of the Autzen Stadium. And Bill Cram Presents wasn't too happy with us. But later on, I found out that through people we know who are related to the people in that circle, mm-hmm. that Jerry thought it was hilarious. Mm-hmm. You know, he has a sense of humor about himself. But there was like, I remember one that just, I don't remember what it said, what exactly the thing was, but it was a giant person in a room, and then a beaker or a cylinder of water filled up with like another human being inside the beaker. It was just like this weird, dark thing. It's a lot of space alien. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember.
And where's Wayne now?
Wayne's living in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. He's making posters for a lot of silent film stuff, and he did the library. Remember the San Francisco library system did a book sale, and he did the poster for that. And he's still doing it. Still there. Hmm. I don't know what else he's doing. He used to work at Amoeba. Hmm. I don't think that was a long while ago. I don't know what he's doing right now. Hmm. I'm trying to remember one of those. The one that really there were so many of them. Now he put out. Oh, the best one.
Hmm. Best what?
Poster. Mm-hmm. And ended up being the cover of his book called I'm Totally Helpless, mm-hmm. which was a book put out by this comic book company in Portland, which was a book of his posters, mm-hmm. which was, you know, he did it for Billy Jack, the Daddies. He did it for every band that came to, like he did, WoW. He did posters for the WoW Hall, mm-hmm. and bands that came through. And it was a clown in a bathtub, a clown in a filled bathtub full of water, reaching out to grab a toaster, and the clown is saying "I love you" to the toaster as he's like reaching for it to put it in the water. That is Wayne. Wayne's posters in a nutshell right there. The funny thing he did for Emergency Horse was this guy standing at a desk and his brain being sucked into the wall, his head being sucked into the wall. It was an amazing for Timberline, I'm sorry.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of people in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, all the way up through, well, late 90s probably,
yeah.
would recognize.
No, Wayne did it through till I died, until I was, you know, until 98 for the Daddies.
Right. Yeah. All right, well, we're talking with Howard Liebes, local author, music business veteran.
That would be me. Yeah.
And Eugene resident.
Yes.
Thanks, Howard.
Thank you. Oh, you should mention my book.
Oh, right. what's the name of your book, Howard?
The name of the book is called When All Else Fails. Mm-hmm. It's a dystopian sci-fi. It's the first book in the Cedar series, which is a dystopian sci-fi series. Mm-hmm. Which takes into account many things. It could be this planet we're talking about.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, I didn't get that when I read that.
Really?
But you know, I'm a little bit slow.
I heard that.
Yeah. From who? All right. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you.
Now for some housekeeping. HugeCast would like to thank our contributors, volunteers, and sponsors. A huge thanks goes out to Mark Davis at Eugene Tech for providing enthusiasm. And to Trefoya for providing equipment, space, beverages, and the occasional pizza. HugeCast's executive producer is Lauren Brown. Our producer and current volunteer wrangler is Kimberly Noel. Audio editors include Mike Jones and Clark Staser. Music and soundscapes conceived by Mike Jones. HugeCast interviewers are Adam Wendt and JoJo Jensen. And let's not forget our intern dude, Christopher Mitchell. Thanks for listening to this episode, or sleeping through it. Either way, thanks.